Welcome to Sound Off 123 here on SCScoops.com for Sunday, August 29th, 2010. I am the Solid Monster here with you and getting up a late Sunday podcast this weekend. Hope everybody had a good weekend, a good week. This show may be a little short, a little abbreviated here this week. I am just completely wiped out right now. It has been an exhausting week, more so an exhausting last 4 days and nights for me. You know, work hard, play hard, that sort of thing. So I'm going to get to a couple of news items, bang out a couple of questions, and then probably just collapse in bed. So let's just run through a couple of different things here. First and foremost, I did not see Raw this past Monday night. I have not gone back and watched clips from Raw. I do know what happened. It sounded like a pretty ho-hum show, but I don't want to sit here and judge it because I haven't watched it, and I probably am not going to go back and watch it. So I did hear that John Cena and The Miz had a fine match for the 12 or 13 minutes it went. You know, we had a six-pack challenge coming up at the pay-per-view, Night of Champions, Wade Barrett in the match, Randy Orton, Sheamus, Chris Jericho, Edge, John Cena getting a title shot, whoop-de-doo. But yeah, I didn't see Raw Monday, so can't really talk about it this week. I did catch parts of Impact on Thursday after the fact on YouTube, and I wanted desperately to see this segment that included Serge Salinas, who of course is now known worldwide as the husband of Dixie Carter, involved in an angle involving Fortune on TV this past Thursday night. Basically, Dixie's in the ring doing a promo with Ric Flair in the ring with the members of Fortune. Flair takes off his jacket after Dixie announces that she's suspending him indefinitely, and Flair is becoming more animated and perhaps more aggressive towards Dixie, and then out of nowhere, her husband runs into the ring, gets tackled by Fortune, gets the snot stomped out of him before being helped out by Kurt Angle, who comes down with Hulk Hogan and the Pope, Mr. Anderson, Jeff Hardy, to try to save the day. When I first heard that Dixie Carter's husband was going to be on TV and involved in an angle, you know, it kind of made my stomach do a couple of cartwheels. At the same time, I can't really say I was shocked, but I wanted to see it with my own eyes, to see how it was executed. And I actually didn't mind that segment, I got to be honest with you, and I think I figured out why. I couldn't really think of why I wasn't more bothered by it after I watched it, but I think what it is, and this is not rocket science, this is not a great revelation, but goddamn is Ric Flair good on the microphone. You can tell how much more fun he is having now that he has the freedom to speak on the mic, as opposed to when he was in WWE, who, of course, they script everything out for their performers, including many of the veteran performers, who, you know, may go ahead and wing their stuff anyway, but everything is very choreographed, very scripted, word for word, very controlled environment in WWE. That was one problem. And the other problem is that they never gave Ric Flair much interview time anyway. I mean, he was on the roster for years. And, you know, when he had a big match or a big program, like the stuff leading up to WrestleMania 24 with Shawn Michaels and, you know, stuff like that, we would see him get some increased mic time. But for the most part, Flair very rarely had a chance to shine on the mic, which is just a complete waste of talent. Now, in TNA, for all of their faults, the one good thing about it is Ric Flair goes out there, he does not memorize any promos. He's not forced to recite word for word something written on a piece of paper. He is given an idea of what he should say and where he should take it. He's given bullet points, much the same way that Vince Russo worked with the wrestlers over a decade ago in WWF during the Attitude Era. That's not to say that things weren't scripted out. Many times Russo would script things out, and you know, there's famous stories of The Rock and Steve Austin being given a piece of paper with what they are supposed to say, and then I think Rock would usually laugh and then throw it away, and Austin would just crumple up the piece of paper and toss it aside. I don't know if Ric Flair is being handed shit that he just throws away, but the fact is he has the freedom to go out there and cut a Ric Flair promo. And even over 60 years old, crazy and senile, and certainly not what he used to be in the ring, Flair is still gold on the mic. And he is still one of the top five performers on the microphone in the business today. And he made that segment for me. He made it entertaining. He made it tolerable. I can do without seeing Dixie Carter and her husband on my TV screen. But I actually kind of liked the segment. I thought it was effective until the EV2 guys ran out. And God, was that sad. You know, Mick Foley was actually at the head of the pack as they were coming out to attack Fortune on the ramp. And my God, was Foley moving slow. Not that I was expecting him to kind of race out there and give Ric Flair a Thez press on the ramp, but it just became very apparent to me when I saw Foley, you know, crawling out there and Tommy Dreamer with his fake-looking punches that this EV2 shit's gotta go. It's just, you know, I guess it gives some of these guys like Sabu and the FBI guys a job for now. It's not like they're making a killing in TNA. I mean, they get paid per appearance. They're not on any sort of real contract deal, regardless of what Dixie Carter said in storyline. But I just could care less about the EV2 guys, to be perfectly blunt. And the Fortune stuff with Flair, I like that. You know, Flair is still a name, and he's trying to give the rub to the younger guys. And you know, it's not a reincarnation of the Four Horsemen, even though maybe they want it to be. I mean, nothing will ever replicate that, but, yeah, Flair was awesome. I didn't really mind the segment that much, but hopefully I won't have to see much of Dixie's husband ever again on my TV. So, with that out of the way, let's tackle some of these stories here. The saddest of them, obviously, being the Luna Vachon story. Luna Vachon, Gertrude Vachon, as her real name was found dead in her mother's home on Friday. I believe it was Friday morning. She was only 48 years old. I believe that preliminary results of an autopsy are due this week, possibly as early as Monday, although it could be a little while longer before we know for sure what killed her. It's impossible to know. You know, was it pills that she was taking? Did she have some sort of heart condition? Nobody knows, but hopefully this week we'll find out more. Her home did burn down in a fire, for those of you who have emailed me. That was a legitimate story. Earlier in the month, actually, I believe at the beginning of August, she lost just about everything, including her house, in a house fire, and was staying with her mother until she passed away. In fact, I know certain people, Mick Foley, for example, was going on Twitter and urging people to donate old wrestling memorabilia like magazines and photos and things that had Luna's likeness that could be sent directly to her, because again, she had lost all of these things in that fire. So, you know, was she depressed and was taking, I mean, we could speculate all day long. The fact is, it still sucks. Yet another wrestling personality dead before 50. What's even more depressing about this, you know, obviously I was more familiar with Luna from her WWF days in the 90s. She came into the company in 93, made her debut at WrestleMania 9 as the valet for Shawn Michaels in the opening contest against Tatanka. You may recall that Sensational Sherry actually came out during that match, and that kind of kicked off a program between Luna and Sherry. And obviously what makes this even more depressing is the fact that Sherry Martel herself is dead as well. She died before the age of 50. She passed away a couple of years ago, and Both ladies are now gone. And in fact, I just thought about this just now, and this is even more morbid, but one of the other things Luna was well known for in the her early 90s run in the WWF was 1994, or late 93, 94, when she was Bam Bam Bigelow's main squeeze. They put the two of them together on the road. She was his valet. You may recall the infamous Doink the Clown Bam Bam Bigelow feud that led to a mixed tag at WrestleMania 10. I'm sure most of you have that on your list of top 10 greatest MSG matches of all time. But the sad thing is, Bam Bam's gone too. And I think he died at the age of... how old was Bam Bam when he died? I guess he was probably about 45, maybe 46. Again, another wrestler dead before 50, so... I'm not even going to talk about the Linda McMahon aspect of it. I mean, Linda McMahon doesn't have anything to do with this, as long as she keeps her mouth shut and doesn't make another stupid comment like she did with the Lance Cade stuff. It's just a sad story. I actually, just to put a personal touch on it, and I mentioned this on my Twitter page, I had an opportunity to meet Luna and actually talk to her back in 1998. It was actually July 13th, 1998. It was my very first Monday Night Raw taping. It was a live show emanating from the Continental Airlines Arena in East Rutherford, New Jersey. I actually won luxury box tickets to the Raw show from a local radio station. And I remember we were the first ones. It was my friend, my brother, my mother, and myself. And we were the, you know, and my mother would love to come to these shows. It was always a trip for her to bring her along because, you know, she's not a hardcore wrestling fan. But, of course, you know, we grew up as wrestling fans. And so, as such, she was subjected to watching it with us. And she had a blast. My friend had a blast. We were the first ones in the luxury box. And I remember jetting for the very front row. You know, I wanted that front row seat, open the windows, the sliding windows to the luxury box. I actually didn't like it at first. In a way, I felt detached from the audience. I like being right in the middle of the crowd, and I wasn't. But these luxury boxes, unlike other places like the Garden and other arenas, were not all the way up. They were maybe halfway up. So we had a pretty decent view of the ring and all the amenities and that you would expect in a luxury box, food, soda, alcohol, private bathroom, all that stuff. And part of the perks of what we won was that during the dark matches prior to Raw, so in that 8 to 9 p.m. hour, four wrestlers were going to be showing up in the luxury box to meet with us for a meet and greet for about 10-15 minutes, sign autographs, take pictures, shoot the shit, you know, that sort of thing. And those four wrestlers for me were Mick Foley in his Mankind gear, except the mask. The mask was not on, but he was wearing, you know, the button-down white shirt with the tie, his usual attire. And this was actually just a couple of weeks after that King of the Ring match, the Hell in a Cell with The Undertaker. So even 2-3 weeks later, Mick didn't look like he was in too good shape that night. Mark Henry was the other wrestler who was in the luxury box. And Owen Hart and Luna Vachon were the other two. And, you know, of course, Owen died less than a year later. He was just the nicest guy, you know. Perfectly normal person outside the ring. Had a little conversation with him. Got an autograph. Got a picture. Owen was fantastic. And, you know, 10 months later, he was dead. Luna was also in the box, and she was a sweetheart. I mean, obviously nothing like the character she used to play on TV. Just very down-to-earth, always smiling, signing pictures. And I remember asking her a question, actually, about her family. You know, Mad Dog Vachon and Maurice. Actually, Maurice, I believe, is Mad Dog. He also had Butcher Vachon. I think I had asked her a question, if I remember correctly, about... it was Mad Dog, it was Maurice Vachon, who was actually the one who had his prosthetic leg ripped off by Kevin Nash in a WWF pay-per-view match back in 96. It was the Diesel Shawn Michaels In Your House match right before Diesel left to go to WCW. And that was shocking at the time, and I actually remember asking her about that, and she was kind of laughing. And anyway, make a long story short, I had an opportunity to meet her as well as Owen Hart that night. So I look back on that fondly, but also I get a little depressed when I think about it, because these were, you know, these were good people, these were family people, who deserved a better fate than they received. And I guess we'll find out more about exactly what caused it, but just a shame. It really is a shame. Unfortunately, Luna is one of many who have passed away just in the last 2 weeks alone. I mean, you know, Lance Cade obviously passed away the week before last at the age of 29. We had General Skandor Akbar, who was in his 70s and suffering for some time from prostate cancer, but he passed away. He was still performing at independent shows right up until the bitter end. Nightmare Ted Allen, who of course was also competing on independent shows until the day he died, and was responsible for training the likes of Arn Anderson and Ray Traylor, better known as the Big Boss Man, among other stars. He passed away recently from a heart attack at the age of 53, either 53 or 54. So, you know, we have those three, and now we find out about Luna. We found out about Tony Bourne, the father of Matt Bourne, who who may be better known to WWF fans as the original and the best, Doink the Clown. Matt Bourne was also a performer on the very first WrestleMania card in 1985. A little trivia note there for you. So yeah, his dad, Tony Bourne, who was in his 80s, passed away as well this week. And I actually just saw a news item up about the passing of another wrestling personality, Mickey Garagiola, or Garagiola, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, at the age of 89, passed away. He was the longtime TV ring announcer for the Wrestling at the Chase events in St. Louis many, many years ago. And he passed away, I believe, if not today, would have been yesterday, Saturday. So just way too many to keep track of. And, you know, they say that these things happen in threes to celebrities. You know, one person dies, there's bound to be two more to follow. And this makes about six different wrestling deaths, at least that we know of, in the last, you know, 10 to 14 days. And you know what? If that's it for 2010, then that would be great if we didn't have to talk about wrestling deaths anymore. Speaking of which, I suppose we should get to these two guys here. They may as well be blood brothers. Let's start with Jake the Snake Roberts. Jake the Snake Roberts. The big news, and we all know how wrestling retirements can go, yada, 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 of course, but Jake the Snake officially announced his retirement this past week from pro wrestling. As a matter of fact, it happened at an event. It was actually an independent event hosted by Squared Circle Wrestling. This would have been, I believe, this was about a week ago, actually. It might have been last Sunday at an event. And Jake, after his match, got on the microphone, talked very emotional about the recent passing of his father, famous wrestler Grizzly Smith, who died, I believe it was last month, or maybe it was actually a couple of months ago, but talking about the passing of his father, and he always wanted to make his father proud. That's why he performed, that's why he wanted to be the best wrestler he could be, and in light of the fact that his father is no longer around, and having to take his own health concerns into account, Jake said that he was quitting, he was retiring from professional wrestling, and thanked the fans. He was very emotional, and walked off. So if that is the last we see of Jake the Snake in the ring, it was a classy way to go out, you know. Would it have been nice for him to maybe give WWE a call and say, listen, I'm really serious about retiring, and, you know, maybe you could bring me in for one of these Legends appearances on Raw, and I get challenged to a match, and I lose, and, you know, give Jake the opportunity to maybe get on the mic on TV in front of a couple of million fans and announce his retirement, you know, something like that. But, I mean, not that WWE is obligated to do anything like that, but that would have been kind of nice instead of, you know, doing it Randy the Ram style in front of about 1,000 people at an independent show. If it is it for Jake, it's been one hell of a career. He's one of those guys I think that you could put on a list of some of the best superstars, at least in the WWF, certainly, to have never won a world championship. And in fact, in WWF, Jake never won any championships. He never became the Intercontinental Champion. He was never a tag team champion. Never won a Royal Rumble or any sort of accolade like that. But he will be remembered career-wise as being one of the more cerebral performers in that company. And indeed, Jake will go down as the all-time, in my opinion, and I won't even say one of, I will say the greatest wrestling psychologist that I've ever seen. And you know, I wasn't alive living through the 50s and the 60s and that sort of thing to see some of the performers of that generation. So, I'm not saying that their ring psychology was not good. But in terms of his promo ability and being able to sell a match and to sell you on how creepy he was, especially when he was a heel. Go back and watch him as a heel in 91 during that feud with Randy Savage, which is my all-time favorite feud and one of the more underrated wrestling feuds, I think, in history. Jake was simply awesome at what he did. In the ring, every movement meant something with Jake Roberts. If it was the short clothesline, if it was a boot to the gut, if it was a slam of some kind, the way that he moved around the ring, everything meant something, and it all led up to the DDT. and Jake perfected that move. He didn't invent it. He wasn't the first one to use it, but he was the first one to popularize it, at least in this country, as far as I know. And certainly on a national scale, the DDT became a move that was synonymous with Jake the Snake. And when he hit you with that DDT, there was no getting up from it. Which just goes to show you how much things have changed, because the DDT has become more of a transitional move, not a finishing move. It's not a move that anybody these days would expect to finish someone off in a match. And it's a safe move, too. It's a move, and this would be a good piece of advice, I think, for a lot of young wrestlers coming up in the business. It's great if you want to be an Evan Bourne and do 450 splashes off the top rope and all that sort of thing and go airborne, but you have to take into consideration that when you are in your 30s and you are in your 40s, you're not going to be able to move around as well as you once did. You're not going to be able to climb that top rope every night. I think the guys that have more of a ground-based arsenal or a finishing move as simple as a DDT, something that they could do at any point in the match from any position, and it doesn't put any real stress on their body. You know, Jake was still doing DDTs up until this week when he retired. That move used to mean something. Now it really doesn't mean anything at all, unfortunately. But Jake will go down as one of the best guys, I think, certainly in that company, to never be a world champion. I mean, he's right up there with Ted DiBiase. And DiBiase and Jake, neither one of them were great, great master, you know, technicians in the ring. Bret Hart could run circles around those guys. Shawn Michaels can run circles around those guys. But they were still great. They were great performers in their own way. They were very good wrestlers. And they're a dying breed. You don't really see people like that anymore. Now, Jake has had a rough life. His problems have been well documented. If you've never seen the Pick Your Poison Jake Roberts DVD that WWE put out a couple of years ago, I would highly, highly recommend renting it, if not buying it. I mean, the documentary is quite disturbing and jarring in many ways. But it's a good piece of business, and there's some good matches and segments and promos on there, and it would really give you a good sense of the kind of performer that Jake Roberts was. And by all accounts, he's cleaned himself up and seems to be doing okay for himself, but he and Scott Hall, I kind of put them in the same boat when it's almost like the boy who cried wolf. You know, you can only cry so many times before people just don't give a shit. And Jake has cleaned himself up and fallen off the wagon and cleaned himself up and fallen back off the wagon so many different times. I mean, for his sake, I hope he's cleaned his act up, but who the hell knows? You know, maybe he walked out of the ring that night after that emotional speech and, you know, went backstage and got his bag and left the building and bought crack on the corner. I don't know. I hope not. But I was, you know, the one who made those comments a while back. This was actually Sound Off 41, for those of you longtime listeners who want to refer back to episode 41. It was episode 41 when I made the proclamation that Jake Roberts would be dead within 5 years. And I would say episode 41 was probably, I mean, sometime, had to be sometime back in mid-08, I want to say, maybe the summer of 08. And so Jake is still around. Jake is still kicking. God bless the guy. I hope he lives to be 100. I don't want my prediction to come true, but Jake was, even up until 2 years ago, getting involved in a lot of bad shit. And I remember going on the podcast, and I was pissed off, and I said, Jake Roberts is going to be dead within 5 years. I think there was an incident at a house, an independent show, where Jake was clearly in no condition to perform. He was missing his cues. He was fucking things up. I think he may have pulled his dick out. There was a match where he pulled his penis out of his pants at one point. Or was threatening to urinate in the ring or something like that. Hence my prediction at the time that Jake was on a path to nowhere. And if indeed this is the end of the road for him, it might be the best thing for him. And hopefully he finds peace and happiness and can live out the rest of his days and end things on a positive note and not have a sorry ending to the Jake Roberts story. Now, speaking of sorry stories and sorry people, that brings me to Scott Hall. Scott Hall is another one of these guys who cleans himself up, seems to be doing fine, very articulate, has a great mind for the business. I mean, say what you want to about Scott Hall as a person, as a backstage shitster, as a performer, he was very good. He's a very good in-ring performer. could have been a world champion too, I think. I mean, you know, kind of, he's kind of in that same boat as Owen Hart, I think, where it could go either way. But I think he could have had a run, perhaps a heel run with the world title when he was really hot in the early days as the Razor Ramon character. But again, here's a guy that has so much talent. He's a smart guy, and he just keeps fucking up. And it just makes you want to just grab him by the shoulders and shake him and say, what the hell is the matter with you? You've got kids, you've got a family, you've got, you know, fans all over the world, you've got friends in the business like Kevin Nash and Triple H and Shawn Michaels and Sean Waltman and people who care about the guy. And, you know, those Last Call with Scott Hall videos on YouTube that he was doing for a while there were even more entertaining than three-quarters of the stuff we would see on wrestling television these days. But apparently, he is still battling those proverbial demons and has been getting into a fair bit of trouble lately. And his handler had claimed that he was... because you may recall, Scott was supposedly in the hospital many, many, many weeks ago, suffering badly from a bout of pneumonia, which may well have been true. And he was supposed to make appearances at some independent shows coming up, including an independent show here in New York, in Brooklyn, at MCU Park, which is the minor league baseball stadium for the Brooklyn Cyclones. That's where TNA had their big show in early July that I was at. And Scott Hall was supposed to be at this particular event coming up back on the 20th of August. And sure as shit, Scott Hall no-showed. He couldn't show because he was back, as it turns out, in mandatory 50-day WWE-sponsored rehabilitation. So Scott Hall is, in fact, back in rehab. Kevin Nash confirmed it on his Twitter. And he's getting the help he needs on Vince McMahon's dime. I don't know how many times WWE has paid for rehab for him. I'm sure it's been at least two or three different times. He'll be there, I guess, for 50 days. And when he gets out, we'll see how Scott Hall, you know, if he makes the changes he needs to make in his life. It's just sad. It's sad to watch these guys just unnecessarily do this to themselves. But hopefully it serves as an example for other people to make sure they got their shit together and, you know, don't be like them. You know, Jake Roberts and Scott Hall are two of the smartest guys that have ever worked in the wrestling business. And I've met Scott Hall once. I've never met Jake. I don't know them personally. I don't claim to know them personally, but I know enough about them to know that they could, each one of them could contribute a lot to WWE or TNA if they had their head on straight. And I'm not so sure being on the road and being in the business anymore is a good thing for either one of these guys. But that being said, if Scott Hall was working for TNA, not as an on-air performer, but maybe in a creative role or as an agent, I think he would be very valuable. Jake Roberts would be indispensable if he was hired by WWE tomorrow to work with younger talent on their promos. And Jake also, you know, at one point was doing creative or was offered to do creative for WWE. And, you know, I would certainly be interested to see what some of Jake's storyline ideas would be. But can you imagine being a young guy in the ring, maybe one of these NXT guys, in the ring before a show, night in and night out, getting personal, direct, one-on-one mentoring from Jake the Snake Roberts on how best to cut a promo? You know, Wrestling Psychology 101. Both these guys can be very valuable in the modern day, and it's just a shame that neither one of them right now are employed by either of the two big companies, but it's not really all that difficult to see why. You know, they made their bed and they have to lay in it, but hopefully all's well that ends well for Jake Roberts and for Scott Hall. The other big piece of news that occurred that I haven't really talked about yet is the release of Serena Deeb from WWE. Better known simply as Serena, part of CM Punk's Straight Edge Society on Friday Night SmackDown. Serena cut from WWE, which well in her future endeavors, as always. The word, basically, is that it was a disciplinary thing, basically. It wasn't that they didn't have anything for her. I mean, in fact, they had big, big plans for her. The prevailing thought is that they were actually moving ahead with this storyline where, you know, some weeks there would be dissension in the ranks of the Straight Edge Society, and perhaps as early as that first live episode of SmackDown on Sci-Fi coming up at the beginning of October, it would be revealed that Punk and Serena were having some sort of intimate relationship with each other, and perhaps that would have led to the final destruction of the straight edge society. You know, Luke Gallows and Joseph Mercury could take no more. So I guess we'll never know where the storyline was going. But from what I understand, it was just a situation where she was behaving in such a way that she basically fucked herself and wasn't living the gimmick, is what I saw written in the, I believe it was the Wrestling Observer, and not living the gimmick. So I'm not sure if that means she was going out and just partying hard every night and just being generally obnoxious and it cost her her job. I'm not sure if that means, you know, what other sort of behavioral issues she was having. But there you go. Serena gone from WWE, and that's a shame because we haven't seen much of Serena in the ring recently. She was only first now beginning to wrestle on TV in matches, but she's a good talent. You know, she actually is a female performer with talent who has a clue. She was a lifelong wrestling fan, very passionate about it, wanted to get into it, and apparently was a shining star in developmental in Ohio Valley Wrestling, I believe it was. And I guess really wasn't getting any attention and felt that she had to get a nose job and had to get a big boob job because, shockingly enough, those huge boobs that she had were not, in fact, real. But she got them because she felt she had to, and sure enough, it got her noticed, and it got her on TV, so it must have worked. And I don't know if they're going to try to fill that position with a different female in the straight edge society, if they're just going to, you know, be one less member and that's it. I don't know. I don't need to know if they know, but it's a shame. She had a lot of potential, and I guess, you know, everyone at some point gets a second chance, and if I had to take a guess, my guess would be that we'll see Serena back in WWE at some point. Not anytime soon, but certainly at some point, you would have to think that she would be given an opportunity to make a comeback. One other quick note. A couple of people have emailed asking about this secret Florida-based wrestling promotion, and Solomonster, have you heard any new news on it? Anything new on this project? And I would advise you all to check out the latest SE Scoops mailbag. If you scroll back, it's on the main page, seScoops.com. There's a new mailbag that went up, and we answered this question, gave the latest details. Not looking too good, although the promotion does have a name now. Apparently it's WWP, or Worldwide Wrestling Promotions, which is not the best name in the world, but there you go. The bad news is that originally the first events were slated to be held around October of this year. And in fact, the contracts that many of the wrestlers who are under contract signed were set to really kick in September, and they would begin getting paid next month. So a letter was sent, an email was sent out from Sean Davis. His real name is R. Sean Pasco. He is the head cheese, if you will, for WWP. And mentioning to everybody that they were going to have to push things back to the beginning of 2011. So January at the earliest is when things would get off the ground. Apparently, the financiers behind the project were not prepared to begin rolling things out in September, or October for that matter, and told the wrestling people, I know you don't like it, but tough shit, the money isn't there. We need to push this thing back until the early part of next year, and so that's what happened. So usually with these things, that's a bad sign. This is certainly not a good sign, but until the beginning of next year, I don't believe we're really going to hear a whole hell of a lot new as it relates to this project. Perhaps new people will sign up with them, will sign contracts, but otherwise things are kind of quiet right now. And by the way, for the people who keep writing in saying, oh, you know, when is the Mets, the New York Mets' new wrestling promotion opening? Let me make one thing perfectly clear. And trust me, I know of what I speak. The Mets have absolutely nothing to do with this. This has nothing to do with the New York Mets. This has nothing to do with the Wilpon family. Somebody calling himself Milton Wilpon is apparently one of the financial party, if you will, behind the project. To the best of anyone's knowledge, there is no Milton Wilpon. And even if there is a Milton Wilpon, it's a distant relative that has absolutely nothing to do with the Wilpons who own the New York Mets baseball team. So there you go. The Mets have nothing to do with this. They're not starting a wrestling league, although that would be kind of funny. My hope would be that if the Mets were to start a wrestling league, they at least would put a better product out there than the New York Mets of late. We won't get into that right now. But anyway, so that's the last word on this thing. It's been delayed, and that's never a good sign. And there's a lot of wrestlers who signed on with them who are now very skeptical. They were looking forward to getting their paycheck starting next month. Now that will not happen, and I suppose they could continue wrestling elsewhere on the independents. I don't think these contracts they signed were exclusive in any way. But it sucks. You know, a lot of people were very excited about it and still are, but just going to have to wait a little bit longer. Kind of like me. You know, I can't wait for this Verizon iPhone to come out. I pretty much made up my mind. I have a BlackBerry right now. And I refuse to switch to AT&T because their service is absolutely piss poor. And the rumor has it that Verizon is getting the iPhone next year, possibly as early as January. I guess we'll find out. All I know is that I was in the Apple store a couple weeks ago. I decided to pop in there. I'm not one of these Apple fanboys where I have to have an Apple this and Apple that and buy fucking apples from the supermarket every day. But I will say they make some pretty good products. So I decided to mosey on into the Apple store and, you know, load up SEScoops.com on some of the laptops and see how fast they went and download the sound off. I actually did that once. I downloaded the sound off. And I played it in the media player, and I left it, and I left the store. So whoever the person was who took that computer over after me may well be listening to this podcast right now. I may have made a fan that day, but anyway, in the Apple store, playing with the iPhone 4, it is just a phenomenal device. I know the Droids are pretty good, too. I was playing with some of those the other day, but my God, is the iPhone cool. Where have I been the last couple of years? So I have to wait for the Verizon iPhone, and all the Florida wrestling fans apparently will have to wait until January of 2011 as well for the promotion to hopefully have their first event. Again, they have people under contract like Vader, Vader's son Jesse White, Sean Waltman is under contract. I don't know if Shane Douglas is. There's a whole bunch of Ring of Honor people, apparently, Ring of Honor wrestlers apparently, who are under contract as well, although I have not heard any specific names. So perhaps those names will begin leaking out over time. All right, so let's get to a whole bunch of your questions here. Got some good ones this week. Let's go to this one first. This is one that was actually asked last week. I didn't have time to get to it, but it's a good question. David wants to know, what time period in WWE history do you feel the roster was at its absolute strongest peak in regards to talent and how the talent was being used? Strongest roster. Well, it wasn't the Attitude Era. It definitely was not the Attitude Era. You had a lot of good characters. You had people who were being used. Even mid-card feuds meant something on TV. You had main eventers like Austin and Rock and all that. But the fact is, there was a lot of guys on that show in 98-99. For example, The Godfather. The Godfather is not a great wrestler. He had a good character, but I would hardly say that that time period was the absolute strongest in regards to talent. Instead, I would actually say that 2002, 2003, WWE, especially on the SmackDown side, like right after the brand's first split, and that might have been actually around the time that Paul Heyman had the book on SmackDown. I mean, you had Brock Lesnar, you had Chris Benoit, you had the world's greatest tag team and all those awesome matches with, you know, Kurt Angle, and even had Hulk Hogan on the roster, who, you know, even at that point was old and could barely move, but you had all these younger guys that could go, these real athletes mixed in with veterans like Hogan and that sort of thing. So I think 2002, 2003 SmackDown, when SmackDown actually at that point was the A show over Raw, guys were being used, guys had immense talent, and having all that talent in one place made for some fun SmackDown programming back then. So that would be my answer to that. Conrad writes in, Dear Solo Monster, I've been listening since episode 1, and had a couple of questions here. With Alberto Del Rio, Sheamus, Drew McIntyre, Daniel Bryan, etc., etc. What five superstars do you see as future big money players in WWE? And please include one dark horse pick that you think people won't realize. Well, as I said to Conrad in my direct response to him here, in no particular order, if I had to list five guys off the top of my head, The Miz would obviously come to mind. He is on the cusp right now. Even if he cashes in and does not win the championship, The Miz is going to be a big-time player. We're already seeing that. Daniel Bryan. I don't really think I need to say much more than that. There is the potential for that company to make a lot of money with this man if they use him the right way. Sheamus is another one. Skip Sheffield, even though he is injured right now, is on my list of, as far as a dark horse, especially with this whole Nexus storyline, Skip Sheffield is the epitome of a dark horse. This guy could be big. And I don't just mean physically big. I mean big in the wrestling business. And fifth guy, I'd probably go with Tyler Black, who, of course, is the reigning and soon-to-be former Ring of Honor champion. He is already reported to WWE Developmental. He did accept the contract with them. I think I mentioned that last week. And he's being allowed to honor his remaining commitments with Ring of Honor and drop the belt at some point, which, if I had to take a guess, would probably be their next big internet pay-per-view coming up in New York City on September 11th. And then at that point, Tyler will completely be immersed in his WWE Developmental career. Now, I would be nothing short of stunned if they allowed him to keep that name. And Tyler Black, I think, is a pretty cool name, so God only knows what they're going to make him change his name to. I don't even want to think. I mean, but poor Tyler, I'm sure, is going to be forced to change his name sooner rather than later. But Tyler Black is a talented kid. I mean, I went to Ring of Honor shows when he was, he wasn't a main eventer, that's for sure. He was part of the faction with Jimmy Jacobs, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, but he worked his way up, he worked his ass off, he got better, he started being pushed more as a babyface single instead of a heel, became the world champion. Some people think that Ring of Honor waited a little too long to put the belt on him. He wasn't as over as he once was, but he's a talented kid, he speaks well, he's young, and WWE, again, can make a lot of money with him if they use him the correct way. So that, of course, is the big if right there. So Rob in Bangalore, India writes in, Dear Solid Monster, where is The Rock? There was so much of a hue and cry in January about him coming back in the summertime and doing something really special on Raw. Well, now the summer is almost over and there's no sign of him showing up at all. What a downer. By the way, wanted to let you know that my mother has also began listening to your podcast, even though she isn't that much of a wrestling fan. She enjoyed your epic rant on Michael Jackson. Well, how about that? Now we're getting, first it's girlfriends, and now it's mothers getting into the sound off. Actually, that would be a good question when you guys write in and send in your own questions. To write in and let me know if anybody in your family, friends, anybody that you have been able to convince to either listen to the sound off or, you know, kind of lead them into the sound off and they became a fan and they listen to the podcast now. That would be kind of cool, I think. A question to post all of you listening. But anyway, back to Sarab's question. Have not heard a single thing about The Rock coming back to WWE. The Rock did interviews where he said that he wanted to come back and do something special, but it would only if it was special. He had these potential ideas to do something big. Of course, actually wrestling was not on his agenda, so what that would have been, I don't know. But as best as I can tell, the reason it didn't happen wasn't because it was any sort of falling out or anything like that. He just has not had the time, and now he's filming the fifth Fast and the Furious film. There we go. With Vin Diesel and Paul Walker. I believe they might have already begun filming. I'm not 100% sure about that. But, yeah, that's the best answer I can give you. I have heard nothing new about Rock coming back to WWE. Aaron writes into the sound off here. Dear Soul Monster, I love your show. Two quick questions for you. Number one, I was wondering if the WWE Divas hate Melina. I was watching a preview of a shoot interview with Maria. She said that she got along great with all the divas in WWE, only one she didn't get along with, and she also said the other divas didn't get along with her, and that would be Melina. What is the story behind this? This is the first time I'm hearing of this. I am not aware or have read anything about Maria, or rather Melina, having any issues backstage. I mean, I suppose it's possible, but it hasn't been serious enough where it's been reported as any sort of major news item. I don't think she's ever been in any sort of catfight backstage with any of the other divas, although that would be kind of hot. Sorry, that was a sexist joke on my part. Second question, do you believe that TNA, Impact, and SmackDown will get better ratings if they went live every week? I read the spoilers for Impact and SmackDown weekly, and if they're not that good, quite frankly, I end up not watching the shows. I know that TNA is all about ratings, and I know that SmackDown is in second compared to Raw, but don't you think that more views equals more money? One does not have anything to do with the other. This has been proven time and time again. When Impact went live on Mondays earlier this year, it meant nothing. Nothing to the ratings. If the rating went up or down, it had nothing to do with the fact that the show was live. I like it better when it's live because I do think it lends itself to more of an unpredictable feel when you know that what you're watching is happening as we speak and isn't, you know, in the can, so to speak, for a week. But no, I don't think the ratings would go up at all. I don't think one would have anything to do with the other. So I think it's a terrible idea because going live on TV will cost you a lot of money. TNA cannot afford to lose any more money. That's why they stopped going on Monday nights. There's no way TNA is going to go back to taping Impact live, at least not for a couple of years. As far as I'm concerned, it just doesn't make any sense. They're hemorrhaging money right now. They cannot afford to lose more money voluntarily, so it's not a decision they're going to go ahead and make on their own, you know, unless Spike TV forced them to do so, and maybe they would pick up the tab for it. I don't know what sort of arrangement they might have, but no, I don't think it would have any effect at all. Edwin writes in with an interesting question. Edwin says, at the age of 65, by the way, Vince McMahon did celebrate his 65th birthday this past week, so happy birthday, big guy. At the age of 65, what would you say is Vince McMahon's wrestling and entertainment IQ? Also, what do you say about Dixie Carter's wrestling and entertainment IQ? On a scale of 1 to 10, with a 10 being the highest, I would say 6.5 for Vince and 3.4 for Dixie. Solid Monster, what do you think? Well, I'm not going to comment about Dixie. I think you know we all know what her wrestling IQ is. But as far as Vince McMahon is concerned, I would say his wrestling IQ is probably, I'd give him probably about an 8.5 for Vince. And as far as his entertainment IQ is concerned, I'd put that right at around a 2. That's the difference right there. Vince McMahon does not always make the most sound wrestling decisions, and his abhorrence for this old-school Southern wrestling mentality, his hatred for it, is ridiculous. You know, the fact that we're deprived of things like wrestling managers and things like that because he thinks it's too Southern, it's too wrestling, as though that's a bad thing, that pisses me off. That being said, Vince has been very successful as a wrestling promoter. In fact, it's been the only thing he's been successful at. Whenever he deviates from that and starts a football league or a bodybuilding federation, or he tries to do something else, it always falls flat on its face. Now, in fairness, WWE Films, you know, they've been able to make a little bit of money off some of the movies. In fact, I think they've made money off every movie so far except for Steve Austin's Condemned. And they blame, I think, Lionsgate for not promoting that movie properly, so it's their fault, it's not our fault, whatever. But yeah, Vince knows what he's doing in wrestling. I'd give him a high wrestling IQ and a very low entertainment IQ. I think he's very stuck, in these old ways, and you'll get these lame, outdated 80s jokes that, because they're catering to such a young crowd, a lot of these jokes will oftentimes go over people's heads, and everything goes, you know, the buck stops at Vince McMahon. And, if the rumors are to be believed about this new 24/7 actual WWE channel they're working on for a launch next year, and they're going to have to fill 24 hours of programming, and Vince, let's say, decides, let's get away from this wrestling thing here and see what other sorts of entertainment programs we can develop for this network. At that point, I start to get a little scared. Intrigued, but scared. So my advice to Vince McMahon, and he certainly doesn't need my advice, nor does he want it, but stick to what you know, would be my advice. Asir from India writes in, Dear Solid Monster, during the 2003 feud between Steve Austin and The Rock, leading up to WrestleMania 19, Austin rarely spoke or cut promos in the ring or backstage on The Rock. Let's see here. It was always The Rock pissing off the crowd. doing his concert, blah, blah, blah. Of course, that was a heelish act and very well done, but my problem is, why didn't Austin cut promos on The Rock? I feel it would have been a better build-up to the match. What do you know about this, and did you enjoy the build-up to that particular match, considering the magnitude of it as it was Austin's final bout? Well, first of all, nobody except Steve Austin knew that it was going to be his last match. I mean, I'm sure the company knew at that point, and Austin did, but nobody else knew for sure that it would be Steve Austin's last match. And even if they had, you know, hyped it up as that, nobody would have seriously believed that he would never wrestle again. And, you know, so far he stuck to his guns. And it has been over 7 years, 7.5 years, since Austin wrestled his last match. And so that did make it a big deal. It was a big deal. Plus, Rock beat him for the first time, and Rock never got to win against Steve Austin, which used to piss me off all the time. The thing about Austin not getting any interview time, it certainly wasn't something that Austin requested. I'm sure Austin would have loved to have gotten on the mic and jaw-jacked. And, you know, Austin would sell tickets during the Attitude Era, not exclusively, but in large part because of his promos. He would cut these very serious, very realistic, in-your-face promos. He would talk people into the seats, as they say. And, you know, I don't know if he would have been able to do the same thing at WrestleMania 19. My guess as far as why we didn't see him more cutting promos and such, the difference between Austin Rock in 2003 and Austin Rock at WrestleMania 15, for example, or WrestleMania X7, at those particular WrestleManias, it was a championship match. It was a featured main event match. You know, in many ways, the show was built around those matches, those particular years. Although the WrestleMania 17 card from top to bottom was very strong. It was stacked and will go down as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, WrestleMania of all time, top to bottom. It was in large part because of that match. But Mania 19, Austin had just come back. He had walked out on the company in 02. He was gone for about 8 months. He finally came back. He beat up Eric Bischoff in a pay-per-view match in February and went right into this feud with The Rock. And it almost felt like they rushed it. And that was the other thing. You know, this thing didn't have a lot of time to develop. You know, No Way Out ended. Austin came back to the company, and then seemingly, boom, he was in a feud with Steve Austin. And there really wasn't much to it than that, really. Rock had carried load. He was very entertaining on the mic. But they just didn't have the time to give this match the promotion that it needed, because they had to promote a championship match between Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle. They were promoting Vince McMahon's match with Hulk Hogan, even stronger than the Austin Rock match. You had Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho, which was another highly featured bout. So Austin Rock found themselves at number 3, for all intents and purposes, on the totem pole here. It was not the main event match, and there were no titles on the line. They weren't fighting for anything in particular. There was nothing for Austin really to cut promos about, and they only had so much TV time to dedicate. They weren't going to dedicate all their time to a match that, again, was basically third from the top. So that would be my best guess as to why we didn't hear more from Austin leading up to that match, which, by the way, is my least favorite, I think, of the Austin Rock matches, even though Rock won. And that finish kind of came out of nowhere. You know, he gave Austin a rock bottom, and Austin kicked out. He gave him a second rock bottom, and he kicked out. He gave him a third rock bottom, and then he just pinned him. Clean as a sheet in the middle of the ring. And I enjoyed their WrestleMania 15 match. It wasn't a great match, but I enjoyed it. A lot of energy. WrestleMania 17, obviously a great match. My favorite Austin Rock match wasn't even a WrestleMania match. I actually was quite fond of the match they had on the Backlash pay-per-view in 99, the month after WrestleMania 15. That was the match where, you may recall, The Rock grabbed the television camera at one point during the match. They were on the outside, and they were standing on the announce table, and Rock is filming the crowd. And as he turns around, there's Steve Austin standing up. He flips off The Rock, who holds on to the camera, by the way, on his shoulder, and proceeds to be stunnered on top of the announce table. And Austin retained the title again, beat The Rock, and not only did he have the official championship belt, but he was given back his smoking skull belt, which had been previously repossessed from him. So, anyway, that was my favorite Austin Rock match. The Mania 19 match was not their best outing. In fact, of the three WrestleMania matches, I'd probably put that dead last, with X7 being in the number one spot. And we'll take this question here from Tony, Dear Solid Monster. A couple different questions here. Number one, many superstars after leaving WWE bash the company. Why do you think they bash Vince McMahon and WWE after leaving, but are willing to return to the company if the opportunity arose? Because they are hypocrites. And I'm not saying that I wouldn't do the same thing, but they're hypocrites. It's that simple. I mean, for years, that one of the great examples that I could think of off the top of my head, Road Warrior Hawk hated Vince McMahon. I mean, he worked for him in the 90s. They left. They came back later in the 90s. They left again. And I remember he did an interview, probably multiple interviews, where he bashed Vince McMahon and, you know, just trashed him. And then in 2003, you may recall, there was one episode of Raw where the Road Warriors were introduced in an impromptu fashion to take on Rob Van Dam and Kane in a basic throwaway tag team match. It was maybe 6 or 7 minutes long. That essentially was their tryout. They were trying to make a comeback. I think they had another tryout match before the SmackDown tapings the next night. And obviously, it never went anywhere. And I think later that same year, Hawk actually passed away. His wife had found him, you know, sleeping or whatever, I think on the couch. He had actually died. But wrestlers say stupid shit all the time. But if the pay, you know, is worth their while, you know, and the opportunity arises for them to get back on a national stage on television, 9 times out of 10, they're going to take that offer. And it's because they're hypocrites. It's that simple. I'm not saying they're wrong for doing it, but it's like any other person in any other profession. You're saying one thing and doing another. That, by definition, makes you a hypocrite. It's very simple. Question number two. I've been watching TNA lately, and while they do have a lot of problems, I really like their tag team division. My question is this. Do you think if Vince McMahon had the chance to steal either team from TNA, whether it be Beer Money, Motor City Machine Guns, etc., do you think they would be properly utilized in WWE? I do not. Because WWE clearly does not give two shits about their tag team division. So I don't have any faith at all that they would use those teams properly. And question number three, do you think Kurt Angle should leave TNA at the end of his contract and go back to WWE on a part-time basis to do one more run, get a WrestleMania payoff, and then retire on a good note with the company? I would like to see Kurt back in WWE, but I don't know that Kurt should be back in WWE, if you catch my drift. I think going to TNA, as far as his health and well-being, was, I mean, easily the best decision he ever made. Now, he's been in TNA now for a couple of years, and Kurt Angle, I would love to see Kurt Angle wrestle at WrestleMania again. He's still one of the greatest in-ring performers that the business has today, and he's older now than he was then, and maybe he's healthier, too. You know, I'll leave that up to you to decide, but selfishly, yeah, I'd like to see Kurt come back. I'd like to see him in a meaningful WrestleMania feud with somebody. He's a bona fide future Hall of Famer, as far as I'm concerned. He'll go down as one of the greatest of all time. He, you know, achieved more in a short period of time in that company, if not the entire business, than anybody, I think, in its history. I mean, that first year he came up, he was a King of the Ring winner, a European champion, a world champion, an Intercontinental champion, main eventing pay-per-views, and, you know, making a lot of money. Kurt's a special guy. And Kurt needs to do what's good for him. He seems happy in TNA. He's working with the younger guys. I say let him stay. But if you're giving me the option, you know, do I want to see him back in WWE? Of course I do. Of course I do. Absolutely. So we're going to cinch up the mailbag here. A lot of good questions this week. And I want to hear more from you guys. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. Of course, there's also the new SE Scoops mailbag. From what I understand, there's a really handsome guy that handles that, too. You can reach him at seScoops@gmail.com. But for this podcast, it's still TheSolomonster@gmail.com, Twitter.com/SolomonStr, and, of course, friend me on Facebook at Facebook.com/TheSolomonStr. Now, before we conclude things here, let's have a quick shout-out here. Now, a couple of you guys and gals listening to the podcast are in a relationship. Some of you have a boyfriend, some of you have a girlfriend, some of you just have friends. Some of you have no friends, that's fine. And it came to my attention that we have an avid listener here to the Sound Off named Blair. So Blair, if you're listening, the shout out goes to you. From what I understand, you either have or are about to celebrate a birthday. So first and foremost, happy birthday from the Solomonster. I hope you make it a great one. But this shout-out really doesn't come from me. Oh, no, 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 no. This does not come from me. This shout-out, this happy birthday shout-out, comes from your sweet, darling girlfriend, Sarah. Sarah wanted to do something really special for you, and I can't think of anything in the world. Forget a diamond ring and fancy schmancy gifts and expensive dinners. Fuck that shit. None of that means anything when it comes to a shout-out on the Sound Off. And Sarah knew this. She's smart. On top of being sexy and beautiful and loving and all that stuff, she's smart, too, because she knew that coming to the Solid Monster for a shout-out on his own podcast, there could be no greater gift than that. So, again, Blair, wherever you are, happy birthday. That's directly from your girl, Sarah. She's a sweet girl, and definitely hold on to her. She's worth keeping around, I think. So, happy birthday, buddy. And speaking of buddies, my own buddy, my buddy Pete, Amish Cousin Simon, I should say, of World of Unpredictable Wrestling. I forgot to mention it last week, but congratulations to him and his partner Cyrus on their tag team victory at the WUW August Ambush show last weekend. Sorry I couldn't be there for it. And I know that in due time, the championship chase continues. I know you're going to have gold around your waist, your newly svelte waist, in no time. And when you do, we're going to have to get you on this podcast because, you know, I can't have anybody on this show as my first interview subject unless they've, you know, held a championship at some point. So when you make that happen, I'll make this happen. So there you go. I'm all out. And this podcast turned out to be an hour anyway. It just seems, even when I say that it's going to be a short version, I just can't do it. I can't help myself. What can I say? Sound Off 124 on the air next week. I hope, as always, that you will join me for that. I did forget to do the iTunes plug, but I think most of you know by now. You can get this podcast on iTunes. Just subscribe there, and it'll automatically download. You don't even have to click on the link on the website, although if you want to, go for it, whatever floats your boat. So we'll be back next week with a new show. Hopefully I won't have to talk about any new wrestler deaths. I think we had about 48 of those this week. Hopefully we won't have any more for a long, long time. So enjoy the 900th episode of Monday Night Raw this week, and we'll see you right back here next time. Be well, stay safe, take it easy, guys.
You've been listening to the Sound Monster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing.
Anybody agree with me out there? I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here.
Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business.
On SE Scoops.